everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month. So, my manga of the month was, again, it is about time-traveling Owendon. There's a little more to it, but
I think that's the perfect tagline.
So, if you like that Owendon game. But I think the actual real selling point, not that it is actually about time-traveling Owendon, but more about, like, a guy who wanted to join the Owendon team. He basically gets a chance to relive his high school life and actually join them. And he accidentally drags along this girl whose life he ruins.
Wow.
But the reason most people know it is the main lady who was the writer for Yuri on Ice. And the character designer. And she wrote a bunch of the songs. Saya Yamamoto was really influential and did a lot on Yuri on Ice, but this lady did an equal amount. I think a lot of our listeners were big fans. You see a lot of, I think, in reflection, this is probably Sayu Yamamoto's half, and this is probably this lady's half. So it should have at least part of the appeal of Yuri on Ice. So interesting. And or if you just like, you know, people being able to relive their past with knowledge of the future.
I feel as though that's a really popular right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we talked about it one other time about how there seems to be, obviously it goes through cycles, but
yeah.
Right now there seems to be a real boom of stories where people are reliving their high school.
Yeah, no, we talked about it with another one, and I remember mentioning that there was an American TV boom where there were three shows really close to each other that were all about I'm an adult, but I get transported back to my high school days. But now I know what's going to happen in the future and try to change it.
And we also have SWAT reviews and case closed reviews coming up very soon. Probably at least some of those before the next Speakeasy. So it's worth mentioning here right now. And yeah, because a new anime season is almost upon us.
And it will come upon us at, of course, always the worst possible time for fall. Because it seems like whenever the new anime season either is ending or beginning is when New York Comic Con is.
And we will all be there, so look for probably the next Speakeasy to focus a lot on what we did at Comic Con. And decide whether or not we will ever be returning to Comic-Con. There's a lot to think about this year, probably. Mm-hmm. Feels as if it might be a very pivotal year for the convention.
Especially with that little side project they're doing. But we'll talk more about that when the podcast itself comes up. What I actually wanted to mention is I added to my All the Sabers list. The last one just got up to 100, and I think I'm up to 120-something now. I'm very thorough.
Wow.
A lot of them are just costumes.
Wow.
Ongoing investigations. What we've been reading, watching, and playing. So, there are 4 great classics of Chinese literature. There's the Suikoden, which the Suikoden games are based on, and it's about this corrupt empire, and then 108 heroes have to rise up and overthrow the government, and you get to like learn each of the 108 hero stories and what they have to do to take down this corrupt government. It's also inspired a bunch of other Japanese literature, but the Suikoden games are probably what most people would know it for. It's also Heroes of the Marsh, sometimes it's called. There's Romance of the Three Kingdoms, which is about the very kind of stylized telling of the Three Kingdoms period of China, where everybody's a crazy superhero and the betrayals are extra betrayally and the schemes are extra schemey. That one has influenced countless anime. I mean, I feel like every like 3 or 4 years they'll come out with another either direct adaptation of Romance of the Three Kingdoms or like super stylized version. And then there's The Red Room, which is the only one you never see anime adaptations of because it's very political and it's like a courtly drama. Like half of it is like wordplay. Like there have been translations, but it's like one of those books where like it's better to read it in the actual original Chinese. But I myself read the only work of the four that probably gets adapted into anime either directly or indirectly more, and that's Journey to the West, which is about the monk Zhuang Zhang and his four disciples as they go to India to get original Buddhist scriptures and bring them back. Because there was Buddhism at the time in China, but it was very almost telephone gamed. Like it had gone through several revisions as it went there. So this monk went to basically go back to the source and get like the purest version so he could bring it back. And there is like a chronicle of the Sang Dynasty travels, which is like a very mundane version of that monk's journey. I went here and I met these people and, you know, we stayed at this temple for a week. But this is fantastical. They fight monsters, Buddhist gods and Taoist gods, both either try to help the monk and his companions or try to stymie him. And, you know, it's influenced Dragon Ball Z, the one with the pretty boys.
Al, that is the vaguest description of all time.
The one.
It's that one anime with pretty guys in it?
But it's based on Journey to the West where
Sayuki.
Not just pretty boys and, you know,
free.
Free, heavily based on Journey to the West. Now you know. So I'll admit the reason I decided to read it was that I got the version of the monk in Fate Grand Order and I was like, you know, I've never read Journey to the West and I'm like inspired by getting this character. I'm gonna go and read all of Journey to the West. And I found out some things. So I found out it is not that easy to find the actual full translation of the full story. Most of them are abridged. And I was like, oh, maybe there's a movie or a TV show version. And then I found out from a few people, including this one girl on Twitter, who's like a Journey to the West expert, who's like, as far as I know, there is no TV show or movie version that is the whole book. They're always like very stylized or abridged adaptations of the original book. But I found the classic Arthur C. Wu English translation, which is 1,400 pages.
Now we know why you find it abridged.
And so I was like, no, I'm going to read the real deal. Yeah, after reading it, I will say it was very informative. Like, I definitely felt it was worth my time. But I also see, oh, this is why it's abridged. So it starts off, and for a good one-fifth of the book, the monk does not appear. It is all about how the Monkey King is born, how he gets his powers, how he then even gets more powers and becomes like 6 times immortal. He eats these peaches that become immortal. Then he tricks this Taoist and breaks into his house afterwards and steals his pills that become immortal. And then he drinks this wine that makes him immortal.
Well, to be fair to the book, literally the only thing I know about Journey to the West is the Monkey King. So it makes a lot of sense to me that at the beginning he's the... Because, like, I didn't even know that the monk was the main character.
No. If you read the first fifth of the book, you would not be wrong. Because it is all about the monkey. And then how he basically screws up and gets punished by heaven and sealed in this rock. And it's not like he just screws up once. In fact, they give him these heavenly positions for a while just to stop him from causing all this havoc. And then he just... And then they learned, oh, since we give him more powers and access to places where he can get even more powers, that just lets him up his game and cause even bigger problems. So yeah, we've got to seal him away.
Who would have thought that putting people who are unqualified into positions of power would be a bad idea?
Clearly not the powers of heaven in Journey to the West.
Who could have predicted?
Because you will see that this is a recurring motif.
They learned nothing.
Yes. So he gets sealed away, and then that ends. And then for like three chapters, it is this guy, a fisherman and a woodsman. And they have, the only way I could put it is an ancient Chinese poem disbattle about... Apparently, they were both great scholars who then decided to give up being scholars, and one of them became a fisherman, and one of them became a woodsman. And they meet every once in a while and try to tell each other why their chosen profession is better by throwing mad poems at each other. And this goes on for three chapters as they just throw poems and like, oh man, cool. We still have, you know, we still haven't proven which of us is better. By the way, did you hear this story about this crazy monk? His parents got ambushed by these bandits, and then the bandit killed the dad, stole the mom, and was going to kill the baby, but the baby got sent away, and the baby got raised as the world's greatest monk, and then he finds his mom again, and then he breaks his mom free and gets his dad resurrected, and then he becomes a crazy monk, and the other guy's like, no, I did not. He goes, wow, well, that's the story I had to tell you so we can move on to the next part of the book. And then the monk gets the actual quest to go west. And it turns out the person who gives him the quest is secretly this female Buddha. And then he frees the monkey and he gets Pigsy, who is this like pig demon who used to be a high person in heaven, but he was given a job he wasn't qualified for. And to repent, he has to help the monk get to India. And then there was this Kappa, and he was put in a position of power that he wasn't qualified for. He messed up, and he got sent down to Earth. Now, to redeem himself, he has to help this monk. And then there was this dragon. I think you can guess. But he gets turned into a horse so he can help the monk. So, and then these four help the monk. And the rest of the book, except for the last few chapters, is them going to the West. And they have to overcome 108 trials, because that's a Buddhistly significant number, until they can get to this great thunder temple in India and get the scrolls and bring them back. And they're like three trials after they get the scrolls that they have to get. And they're like, one of them is a turtle that they pissed off, pretends to help them out, and then dumps them in a river. And then all the scrolls get wet, so they have to dry the scrolls. And that's like two of the quests.
That's a dick move.
The one back is like a town that's in trouble, a pissed off turtle, and wet scrolls. So the majority of it is the other 105 trials they have to go through. And I then realized why it's abridged. Because there are essentially five trials. And all 105 are just different variants of these five trials. So one trial is a super powerful demon finds out if he eats Wang Zhang, the monk, he gains crazy powers. So he kidnaps the monk, and then some combination of the disciples have to go and save the monk. By the way, one of the combination is always Goku, because the other three are useless. They are the only thing Goku, the monkey, can't do is fight underwater. And those other two, the two that aren't the horse, are basically there to be okay in fighting in the water so they can get the opponent out of the water or delay the enemy long enough so they don't eat the monk, so the monkey can find some way to get around his inability to fight in the water, and that's about it. Or sometimes they're there to mess up and get captured as well, so then Goku can rescue them. Two, they run into a town or a bunch of people who are in big trouble, and everybody else wants to move on, but the monk is so virtuous, he won't let them move on, so they have to go and help the people whatever problem they have. Three, somebody tries to seduce or corrupt the monk, either by like getting him to eat a non-vegetarian meal or sleep with him or do some kind of get him off the pure path of Buddhism. And they have to like either escape from them or see through their deception. Sometimes they'll combine both of them. Like they're these tree spirits that like try to get him to be decadent and sleep with these women. Four, there's some kind of like hard to pass terrain that they have to find a way to get through. Sometimes they'll have to fight somebody. Sometimes they'll have to negotiate with somebody. And then the last trial is Goku and the monk have a fight. Either Goku's too crude or too violent or too mean, and the monk sends him away, and then they get in trouble and they realize, oh, we all suck, and they have to get back Goku. And those are the five variations. And there are a bunch of different variations, but those are the five general things they have to get through. You know, sometimes the guys have different powers. Sometimes they have to fight with people. Sometimes they have to talk with people. They usually have to, at least at some point in these things, fight with somebody. The only times they usually don't have to fight is when somebody's trying to corrupt the monk. But those sometimes also turn into fights. But yeah, they get through all that. It is actually super anticlimactic when they get to the actual Thunder Temple. Because like, there's at least one time when these guys set up a big Thunder Temple to capture the monk. But when they get there, it's like, man, it was super beautiful. And everybody was super pious Buddhist. And they gave us the scroll. And we studied there for like 2 years. And then we went home. And then they like take care of like the loser quests. And then it's like two chapters of like, here's the easy to understand Buddhist interpretation of all this. Be a good Buddhist, the end.
Well, it sounds like a story where the journey is the important part.
Yeah, yeah, no, no.
Not the destination.
But, I mean, I definitely see why you could basically do, like, a highlight reel. Like, ah, this is, like, the best, like, one or two seduction stories. These are, like, the coolest fights. This is, like, the crazy thing where they have to get through this, like, fire mountain. And, you know, we can cut out the sixth time somebody steals the monk who's gonna eat him for his power. I know it comes up in a lot in Journey to the West. I'm not sure about the Suikoden. I'm pretty sure it's also in the Red Room. But these Chinese classics love to throw in poems. They'll either start a chapter with a poem or end with a poem. Or someone will just break out into a poem. Or they're like, you know, we could just describe this monster or this new country they've come into. Or we can do a poem about it. So yeah, there are a lot of poems. Also, this is a book that has not met a recap it does not like. I don't know this definitively, but it really seems like this was like an orally told story originally, and maybe you'd hear like one chapter a night or a few chapters a night from a storyteller, because every chapter also usually begins with a quick like, here are main characters, here's what they're doing, maybe here's what's happened in the last, like, two chapters, or here was, like, the last two adventures they went on, if they're just starting a new chapter. And so, yeah, I think after a while, yeah, those can all be cut.
You don't think that it was written as a serialization? What makes you think it's oral versus, like, I don't know, in a newspaper or something like that?
For how ubiquitous the story was and how many people could read at the time and how many books could be printed. I don't think there were that many.
How old is it?
It's pretty old. So I think it's before the Chinese had the printing press. So there might have been copies around, but I think it definitely seems like a mass appeal story. And so that's what makes me think.
I didn't realize it was before the printing press. Yes. So, okay.
So yeah, no, there have definitely been written books, but I don't think like the average commoner would have been able to. So.
I see.
And it seems like a story that would have. So, some other little quick observations. One, all the countries they go through that are not India and China are totally made up bullshit countries. Like, they basically at one time passed through the, the country of Amazon ladies.
I think that island's in One Piece.
Yeah. Like, the first people they help out and, like, stay with are these two old ladies. And they're like, you're lucky. We're the first person you helped out because we're old. So we're not really into raping men anymore. But if you had helped out some of our younger sisters, they would have raped the hell out of you. And they're all super strong warriors. And they're all like, phew, I can keep my monthly virtue.
Okay.
But the queen of the Amazons, she is so touched by his virtue that she merely wants to marry the monk and have consensual sex with him before they escape. Some of the villains they have to fight have great names. Like, there's a tiger, elk, and antelope power. So tiger power, elk power, and antelope power. They're these trio of super corrupted Taoist monks who basically are unqualified for the position and then become kings of this land, and they have to be defeated because they're evil Taoist wizards. By the way, all the Taoists aren't evil. There's actually a weird mix of, for a book that's all about Buddhism, there's a pretty liberal mixing of like Taoist and like local gods all being like equally valid, and like all the Buddhist deities help them out, but the Taoist and, like, local deities can, like, go either way. Some of them are, like, super helpful and help them out. And other times they're the bad guys who have to be defeated. Or they're, like, neutral and kind of have to be, like, coerced into helping. So, I just thought that was interesting that, like, it was, like, pretty liberal, like, seeing other religions in the book. Oh, and my other favorite trio is they were the kings of cold, heat, and dust protection. And they're pretty much like the last bosses. There's like one or two other guys they have to fight after that, but like they're like nowhere as powerful as
I'm just picturing them as like Heat Miser and Cold Miser.
And Dust Miser.
Yeah, I think that was probably their cousin.
Oddly enough, Kate, that was my exact
Maybe those are base. Like, those characters in
the Rankin Bass.
Yeah, were based on Journey to the West.
So they caught, I missed the Dust Miser.
Look, they only have so much time.
There you go. Somewhere hidden out there is maybe the Dust Miser song. I guess the question is it worth reading the whole 1,400-page book as opposed to the abridged versions or, like, a lot of the movies that are abridged? I don't know. It depends. I feel like so many of the stories are very repetitive and follow a formula that if you just wanted the... There's, like, Red Boy, Demon Bull King, and Princess Iron Fan. They're, like, three members of a family, and they're all, like, they meet Red Boy pretty early on, and they, like, defeat him and convert him to Buddhism, and then he becomes, like, a Buddhist helper. And so, like, then his mom and dad, the Bull Demon King and Iron Fan, like, vow revenge, and then he has to fight both of them in separate chapters. They'll probably be in everyone because they're, like, super classic. And so you'll probably get most of the highlights. The reason to read the full expanded one is if you're more of a scholarly bent, because like the full Arthur Wu translation, he's the first English translation to keep in the poems and translate the poems because he felt they added a lot to the greater story and had a lot of Buddhist symbolism. But I mean, it is still 1,400 pages.
Well, I think, obviously I haven't read it, but I feel like in the context of, is this worth reading 1,000 pages of? Not whether or not each story has relevance, but if it's entertaining for 1,000 pages. Because if really, if Or, like, obviously, if you're very interested in philosophy of Buddhism, sure, maybe you would get a lot out of 1,000, like 1,000 pages. But if you're, I think it sounds to me, like, the way you're describing it is that if you want to understand what this story is and how it comes up in a bunch of things, you don't really need the 1,000-page version.
If your interest is not academic, not religious, then the simplified version will give you, because really what you need to know is the origin of monkey, basically the five basic formulas, and then the conclusion and the origin of Swang Zhang. So yeah, I think for like most of our listeners, an abridged version is more than enough, or there's some very good movies that once again are basically like highlight reels.
My question to you is, do you now see, when you were reading it, did you see how it influenced certain things?
Oh.
What, and did you feel like you got such a better understanding?
So, I immediately, and this came up at a panel I went to at Otakon, see, oh my gosh, Inuyasha is totally, like, based on Journey to the West.
See, that's a different one that I don't feel as though that's not the first thing that comes up.
Because, like, the monkey originally doesn't want to follow the monk. He's like, this monk is a boring prude. He only eats vegetarian meals. He doesn't want me to do violence. After they get through the first quest together, he's like, I am out. Sure, like, the forces of heaven are going to try to capture me, but it's worth it better than sticking around with this square. And so the female Buddha, who helps them out a bunch of times, one of the first times she comes back, she's like, hey, this is a super cool headband. Put it around the monkey's head, and when I give you the special command words, you can make it, like, basically squeeze his head, and he'll have to listen to you. And so it's basically the necklace that Kagome gets that keeps Inuyasha in line. And then once again, I would bet you if you went back, I'd have to look. But I wonder if they basically have to collect 108 jewel shards, or if they have to do 108 like trials to get reform, you know, the stone. And the traveling companions, I'm sure they have, if I thought about it a little more. But yeah, if you start lining things up, you're like, oh, Inuyasha is Goku, Kagome is Swang Zhang. This is basically Rumikio Takahashi's Journey to the West. You'll see it in, like you said, Sayuki. You'll see it in Dragon Ball. Although, you know, they, obviously, Toriyama is much more liberal of what he takes and adds and removes with Dragon Ball. I think that it's one of those things where it is so influential, and it's probably the most accessible of the four Chinese classics. You know, there's an old saying, never let young men read the Suikoden, and never let old men read Romance of the Three Kingdoms. Because the Suikoden's all about rebellion and stuff, and it's very kind of specific tales, and Romance of the Three Kingdoms is so very political, but Journey to the West really, really feels like a shonen anime, because they set up a premise, and then they have an easily repeatable formula of fights and adventures and dramas until they eventually get to the end of the story. So I feel like even the structure itself has gone on to influence so much anime that I think it's at least worth it reading an abridged version, because you will begin to see pieces of it everywhere, because it's just so easy to influence anime, and I think just it has influenced a lot of anime in that way.
The only journey I've been going on lately is with Octopath Traveler. So I think a lot of people have been playing this recent Switch RPG because it's one of the first ones to come out, and it has a really unique art style, and it's a very classic JRPG. Goes back to like sprite animation, so has a lot of a sort of a retro look, but also has some modern touches. Like I said, the environments are probably like the coolest thing about it. If you've seen any images of it, it almost looks like dioramas. It has a three-dimensional look to it, but at the same time, it's not three-dimensional. It's has just like this, it's flat and three-dimensional at the same time. And so it has like some cool textures. Sometimes it almost looks real, as if it was made from something in the physical world and then put it, I don't know. It's such a cool looking
aesthetic.
Yeah. And that was the thing that really stood out to me, because I haven't played a classic JRPG in a really long time. And the ones that I have played more recently are really just nostalgia plays from stuff that I played on Super Nintendo and things that I loved, like Chrono Trigger and things like that. But I hadn't picked up a new type of game like that in a long time. And, you know, it's turn-based battle system, jobs, like job system. I know that people said there, I think a lot of like people who worked on Bravely Default, which I didn't play, worked on this game. The main, I don't know what you want to call it, the conceit, I guess, is that there are 8 heroes. You can start as any of the 8 heroes. They all start at a different town in the world, and you can go and add them to your party and learn all of their stories, and they all have these big kind of involved backstories and journeys that they're all going on. And you can, each town, not every town, but many of the towns, that's like where the next part of their plot is, and you can choose whose stories to sort of prioritize if you want, or you can play all the stories at once, reveal the rest of the world as you go along. And you can kind of pick and choose if you don't want to play all 8 at the same time. I think the thing is, for me so far, which I'm just, it's not clear really, is whether or not these characters' stories are interrelated. Mm-hmm. Beyond, hey, we met up in a town, I decided to help you out on your journey, cool, I'm here to do that. And they'll have little like side conversations that are really just sort of flavor so far. And so even though, say, 2 characters, maybe their next chapter in their stories both happen in the same town, they're not directly related necessarily. And so it's interesting, because I think I kind of went into the game with some different expectations about that, but since I haven't completed the game, I don't actually know if that changes or not, because I really didn't realize that when I started it that you could play everybody at once. I thought, okay, you go through this as the character that you started with. You can add these people to your party, but you don't really get like their full story unless you play as them. But that's not really the case. You really could play through the game one playthrough and get everybody's stories should you choose to do so. So on the one hand, I think a lot of people probably appreciate that because they maybe don't want to play the game 8 times. But I, on the other hand, thought that that would have been really cool, that it just created a lot of replayability were I to not be able to know everybody's in-depth story from the beginning. And I also thought that the characters would be more interrelated, because so far there doesn't really seem to be a grand, you know, there's not like a grand boss, right, that has come to destroy this land or something like that, like something very, very classic. So it's not as if they're all journeying together to like go kill the boss. I mean, each of them have their own plot story where there are mini bosses and bosses. And, you know, they're all trying to get to different destinations and whatnot. But there doesn't seem to be any, we all come together and take down this dude or whatever.
It's not like they're all people that these people are up against. They're all like part of some grand organization 13 type.
Right. Or that at least does not seem to be the case thus far. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if you're playing a game of big and small side quests, almost. Mm-hmm. Which I find kind of interesting. There's a lot of little side quests in the game, because one of the things I do really like is that every town, as things change in the story, the town changes a little bit. So you might go to a town at the beginning, talk to everybody there, but if you help somebody there or you go and do a plot thing, you might come back and there might be different people at the town, or like a person that you met in that town, you might go to another town and then they've gone there and their story continues, even though it's a really like background minor thing. And then you can help them continue their little mini story. So there's a lot of possibilities because you can talk to everybody in every town, and there's like a billion people in every town, and each of your characters have a special ability that they can use in town. So your thief can steal from people, your fighter can provoke people into a fight, and so you can use these different things to sort of navigate the town, learn different things, gain information and stuff like that. One of the problems I think with that is I feel as though there are 8 characters, but I feel like there are only really 4 powers. And they call them different things, but they're essentially the same, except half of the characters can do them without any consequence, essentially, and the other half of the characters can do those same things, but they might not succeed at doing them. So it doesn't really seem to have a lot of point. So, for example, I started as the scholar because he seems sort of, he's like a detective kind of. He's like obsessed with finding out the puzzle and the mystery. So his power is investigate, but it has a percentage chance of working or not. The apothecary, who I got later, has, I forget what his power is. I mean, I forget what it's called, but essentially he can just get people to talk to him and there's no percentage variant. So why would I ever use
the scholar?
Except your main character is locked into your party, so they can never not be in your party. Everybody else, you can, like, switch in and out. So the thief, I guess this one is different enough. So the thief can steal with a percentage of, you know, maybe doing, they're different percentage for different things you're trying to steal. And then the merchant can just buy stuff from those people. So I guess in that case, those are two different, pretty different things. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like they could have just come up with more things for people to do. I'm not sure. I feel like it's a little bit wobbly. I love everybody's stories, though. Really interested in everybody's, except probably the knight. The fighter is sort of not super interesting to me, but I'll probably definitely play through all of the stories. And I do really like the world. I feel like the combat system is good. It's fine. It's turn-based. I generally like it. But my big complaint with it is probably that, which would be my complaint with pretty much any JRPG, probably, period, is I think there's too much grinding. I don't think there's an insane amount of grinding, but to me as a player, I think that if I go from town to town in a leisurely pace, not trying to speed run the game, but just leisurely going from place to place, I think that I should get enough experience to progress the story without having to overly go into a bunch of battles. And that's just not possible in this game. It's not ludicrous, oh, I'm not gonna play this anymore levels of grinding, at least in my standards.
Like old Final Fantasy or like certain Shin Megami Tensei games where it's like, oh, you want to progress to the next part of this story? I hope you got 10 hours to grind out.
Even Persona 3 to me had too much grinding.
Well, Persona is considered baby mode for some of the Shin Megami Tensei games, so
yeah,
imagine what those bastards are like.
Yeah, so I just don't want to have to do that. And I'm not saying I should be able to do everything if I don't grind. I'm not saying I should be able to get every job or do all the special side missions or anything. But just to do, like, basic story, I feel that should be enough. Is moving from town to town, getting into your random battles, going through your little, like, dungeon plot parts. And I think that should be enough.
No, I totally get what you're saying. I feel that's a very modern version of RPG. I wonder if they, trying to be retro, maybe took one of the wrong lessons away. Because, well, like I said, a lot of the old Shin Megami Tensei games and definitely some of the old Final Fantasies, especially the old Japanese Final Fantasies, were like, hope you like grinding, because...
But I don't feel it's so bad that I would make it a huge negative on the game. I still really like it, so I'm pretty okay with it.
Yeah, no, the main other criticism, which you touched on a lot, is a lot of people felt that the 8 main stories seem just like each of the characters is on that quest. And they're just these other 3 guys or girls who are randomly in the background. And like you said, even when they're in the same town, they don't seem to interact. Because I have a question for you. What this game always reminds me of is Senken Densu 3, which would have essentially been Secret of Mana 2, because Senken Densu 1 became like Final Fantasy Adventure. Since there was so much text and it was all in kanji, we never got Senken Densu 3 here. But in that one, it was like Secret of Mana, where you played as 3 characters, but there were actually a pool of 9 characters. In every game, you could play 3 of the 9 characters. And apparently, although they went through the same general story, they all started in different places, each of the 9. They all met at the same town. And they would all have the same general place that they were going at the end. But everybody had their own storylines. And in fact, there were certain endings and places you could only get if you brought together certain groups of 2 and 3 characters. Like maybe this wizard and this cleric actually had a shared past. So if they, or maybe they were chasing the same guy. So if they're in the same party, if you have both of them, they can finally take on their shared enemy. And then they'll have an ending of like, yes, they finally resolved that thing. There was a lot of replayability of like which of the 3 you put together. And, you know, maybe, oh, in this playthrough, I now realize that these 2 characters should be on a team together. So in this 3rd playthrough, I'll now have, I'll put these 2 together to know. And so I know people who have played the translated really like that. But on the other hand, it requires you to play the same game multiple times, especially if you want to see everything. And then even more times if you don't, like, follow some, like, optimal path guide to see everything, you might have to, you know, play some, oh, these 3 characters have absolutely nothing to do with each other. And while their interactions, their little things are interesting, I now realize, you know, I should have teamed up these 3 people instead. And I think people were hoping for those kinds of things, but I feel like with 8 players, it seems like they didn't know which ones you'd start with and which ones you'd go to, so they kind of made it as generic the interactions as possible. And, you know, just like you said, the kind of random interactions being the thing. But it does seem to sap out a bit of the flavor that, like, people really remembered for that, you know, Secret of Mana sequel.
I think that individually, I think everybody has some pretty interesting stories. But I would have really liked, not only would I have liked it more if their stories overlapped more, but also if your maybe decisions affected a little bit more of what was going on, because it feels as though certain characters might get along better, or their alignment, you might say, is either in opposition of each other or maybe mm-hmm. works with each other. So, oh, if you have these people in your party, you can't do X. Or, like, I don't know, just have a little bit more effect on what was going on.
So, one other interesting thing about Senken Densu 3 was everybody had upgrade paths. So you could pick, every time you, like, got to a certain level, you could either pick light or dark. And you could do that twice. So you could have a light, dark light, or dark. If you played the same character again, you could go, all right, last time I was light, so maybe this time I'll play dark. And so, and they'd have different powers. So they give you a reason to play the game again. Do you think if you had to play it multiple times, but they did something like you could only play 3 of the people, but their paths interacted more, do you think you'd like it more? Or do you just wish that they still gave you the 8, but there was more interaction.
I personally, I like the idea of replaying a game if it's short enough. So I don't want, oh, I need to replay this game 5 times and it's an 80 hours every time or something like that. That would be, I feel, too much. But if it was shorter and then had multiple playthroughs and you could affect things differently, I think I would have preferred that. The other thing that I wanted to mention about the sort of the gameplay itself is I think it sort of suffers from modern era mechanics of leading you so much. When you turn on the world map, it tells you where on the map everybody's next chapter is, like what town to go to for everybody's next chapter. Or if you don't have all your party members yet, it tells you every town where every character is that you can go get them. And like when you're in a town and you do any of the side quests, which I said I do really like that there was just so much you could do in town and talk to so many people and learn lots of different things. A lot of those side quests are like, then the story or the game itself is like, yeah, now go here. And I don't really, like, I don't like that. I want to discover that those things. I want to figure out the puzzle. I want to find the item that this person is looking for. So I do think that there's just a lot of leading.
And I assume you can't turn any of that off.
Not that I could find. But that is part of the problem, right? Is that some people just want to play, you know, they want that because they don't, they're playing the game to just hear the story and they don't want it to be some sort of difficult quest every time. But like, yeah, and just people play games for different reasons. And like, I'm really there to explore. I really want to explore the world. But one of the leading things that I do appreciate in the game is that when you go to a new area or about to go to a new area on a map, it has a suggested level of what you should be if you go there. So you're not going like Final Fantasy IV style where you're like, I transported to the next world. Oh, shit. Everything kills me and now I can't get back. Like, so that doesn't happen. Which, so I feel like there are parts of it that I do appreciate.
More games are smarter about being able to turn off hand-holding. Look, we realize some people busy and especially with like 8 characters might not remember or like, I haven't played in like a week. Where do I want to go again? I think it would have been wise if they could like turn those switches on and off. Like, oh, I haven't played in a while. Let me turn back on the, which should I be doing switch? All right. That's enough of a refresher. I can turn them back off for. Please hold my hand. Show me the way. So Kate told you her little adventure about playing a game called Octopath Traveler. I'm going to tell you a little adventure about a game I played, which I think has some interesting things to say kind of outside of the game itself. So my main mobile game I've been playing is Fate Grand Order. That should surprise nobody. But every once in a while, recently, I had heard about another game, and then my roommate, I assume through Art, heard about a game called Azure Lane. And so the game general story is there's World War II battleships and they're anthropomorphized into cute girls, and they have to fight evil aliens who are also alien ship girls who are evil. And if you're like, Al, I've already heard that story, it's Ken Kodai, then you are absolutely correct. There was a lot of buzz about the game, and my roommate really liked the art for it. So I got into like the closed beta one weekend, and then after playing for that for a little while, I got into the open beta and the like fully released game. And Azure Lane is made by a Chinese company. And so, I mean, there are definitely original games that come out of China that are very interesting. But if there is a reputation that Chinese games have, it is that they are take popular game, make little to no changes, and then put it out. And the other thing that made me interested in the game was the last two Comiquettes, especially this last one, Ken Kodai is no longer the most doujined thing at Comiquette. It's Fate Grand Order. And while I'm all be Al and give you the praises of Grand Order, I feel like for that to happen, not only did Grand Order have to go in popularity, Ken Kodai had to have a hit. And actually, what happened is Azur Lane has been very steadily eating Ken Cole's lunch. Ken Cole is still really popular. I mean, once again, I think it was only third place this year at the most recent Comic Cat. No one's going to go broke yet selling Ken Cole merchandise. But it was King of the Hill. And now, like, Azur Lane is like 8th or 9th. For a game that's based out of China and basically does a lot of the things that Ken Cole does. But I think there's an interesting lesson. So let me explain very briefly about the history of Ken Cole. And this will come into relevant play. So there used to be this company that used to make 18 plus web games in Japan. And they were doing good business, but they wanted to break into the broader market of not porn games. So they teamed up with Kadokawa, and they were really interested in this free-to-play market that they heard about in the West. So they made a free-to-play game about anthropomorphized ship girls, and it did okay. But then a mixture of two things happened. One, people found it was free to play, so you could get in without having to put in an initial cost, like a lot of the Japanese mobile games at the time. And two, it like started blowing up on Japanese art sites. I'm not sure if Pixiv was around by then, but basically either Pixiv or whatever was popular at the time, and Doujin. And that just slowly got it more and more popular. And it got so popular so quickly that you couldn't just sign up for an account. You had to enter your name into a lottery. And every month they would like, these people won the lottery. Here is your key so you can actually make an account for Ken Cole. Because when Ken Cole was blowing up, I was like, oh, I should try this. It's free to play. I should see what this game is about. And then I found out, oh, all right, you have to read a translation. You have to sign up for a lottery. And this is very important, if you don't use a good proxy, if they ever find out that you're not in Japan, they automatically cancel your account. So basically, they do not want anybody outside of Japan playing Ken Cole. So I don't know if they still do the lottery.
What reason is there to do that? They're throttling their own user base? Why?
Well, when they originally implemented the lottery, they didn't have enough servers for the amount of people playing. So they instituted the lottery. And as far as I know, they've not stopped doing that. Yet, despite the fact that they kicked out anybody who didn't have a Japanese IP and constantly checked for that, and the fact that they had a lottery, Ken Cole blew up. I mean, it was number one the longest time. There was even references in Wodokoi to Ken Cole. So it was this thing. But what I find really interesting is I feel that Azur Lane is succeeding because they do pretty much the same things that Ken Cole does. And they make some improvements. But I feel like they're accessible. Azur Lane says, oh, you're in another country? That's cool. We made an international version for you. You can also still play the Chinese version or the Japanese version. We're not going to stop you. But here's a version for you guys. Oh, you want to play on an emulator instead of on your phone? That's cool. Because a lot of the Japanese mobile games are like, oh, you're using an emulator? We kill you. We kill your account. And, oh, we have a webpage and a Twitter account. And if you have any questions, if we don't have a representative that speaks your language, we'll translate it and answer your question. And I feel like they've just basically embraced like an international audience and just ease of playing that is just not very Japanese. Because Ken Cole, I know it can't use an emulator. It's still very like old web-based. Oh, and the worst part is they're both free to play and so they have gacha. If your ship sinks in Ken Cole, it's gone. You basically have to roll a new one. Whereas, you know, if you just die in Azur Lane, well, you know, you lose that battle and that's fine. Your ship is fine. The next battle just gets fixed.
It sounds like, I don't know, you said it was very Japanese, but it just sounds like very Ken Cole because there's Love Live, Fate.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just, all the Nintendo stuff is all international.
Guess,
like,
The other thing that it reminded me of is why a lot of K-pop bands are super popular now is a lot of, especially like Johnny's kind of Japanese bands, they don't have a lot of social media presence. And there's some exceptions. Some artists go out of their way to have that, but they're usually, that's by their choice, not by the record label's choice. And I know a lot of K-pop bands have really succeeded by doing, basically by reaching out to the international audience, by making everybody much more accessible to both Japanese, Korean, and international media. They're obviously still being at least a little more accessible to all those people as opposed to the Japanese who have that all on lockdown. That's to say that, like, K-pop bands were never popular. They've always had a following here in the United States just because we have a Korean population and a population that's interested in media outside of the U.S. But I feel like very recently there's been an explosion, and I've seen a lot of people point at the fact that the K-pop bands are a lot more willing to play ball and to be international. What I think is interesting is, and what you kind of brought up, I feel like there's the part of Japan that realizes that being accessible, that opening up your markets to the international audience is important. And then there's the part of the industry that is very, no, we're not going to license outside of Japan. No, we're not going to talk. I feel like half of the industry has learned that lesson and half hasn't. And I just think that it just was very eye-opening in that respect that, like, there are still those parts that are kinkole-like that haven't opened up. And I feel like if they don't start doing that, then they're opening themselves up for either some kind of Azure lane or even just a Japanese product that is willing to do the same thing but be more accessible to move in on their domain.
What about the game itself, Al? Or, like, who cares?
So one other interesting thing I found is, so some other thing just before I go into the game itself. So in Kankole, basically the aliens come before World War II. So basically you can skip over the whole Japan and Germany stuff and just have them fight aliens. All this war stuff started basically, I think the Pearl Harbor attack is basically the aliens attacking, and they just skip over everything pre, don't think about anything that happened before Pearl Harbor. That didn't exist. Whereas in Azure Lane, you start off playing as the Americans, and the Japanese and the Germans are the bad guys. And then you have to, like, fight them and then find out, oh no, the real bad guys are the aliens. You have to, like, convert over the Japanese and German ships. But they start off as the sinister bad guys you have to beat. Which I think very much shows which country started which game. But the game itself is interesting, because it's a slightly like bullet hell shooter. Like, you can actually control the ships. So if you're good at moving the little ship girls around, you can, like, dodge attacks and, you know, do extra damage with certain strikes and timing and stuff. If you don't care about any of that, you can just hit autoplay and the game won't play as well. But it will at least give you, like, a modicum of skill, so if you're just totally inept at it. But that just means then you have to invest more in your ship girls to beat harder levels, or, like, you know, basically grind the earlier stuff more, whereas somebody who's, like, really skilled at bullet hell shooters can go in with, like, a weaker team and still win. The game itself, I find it a little annoying because it's a little needy. Like, it really wants you to check in on it, like, every few hours, which kind of a pain in the ass. I can easily just not play Grand Order for 9 hours at work and come back and still be fine. As long as I, like, check in the game once a day and, you know, most days play, like, an hour or two, I'll be fine. Whereas this game really, really wants you to check in on it. a bunch of times a day, which I like. All right, significant other, please find a little of your own hobbies. The other interesting thing that I think is all of the artists for Azure Lane have Pixiv, and I know that the company really went in on hard on Pixiv and getting Pixiv artists to do all the art for the characters. If you like look on the wiki, every ship in the game is like, this is the artist, this is their Pixiv page. I didn't mention that in the earlier part because I don't think it has really anything to do with my point, but I do feel that's one of the appeals, that they specifically scouted Pixiv talent for the game, and that I feel is if you like certain Pixiv artist styles, they went for a variety of Pixiv artists, and I feel like I think once again that's why my roommate's also an artist and likes to follow a lot of Japanese artists. I think that's why he really likes the game.
I think it's really cool that they call them out and then link directly to their work. Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
I feel like it helps the artist because it's like, hey, that's my work. And, getting their names out there. But also, it kind of... It's a nice cycle of positive reinforcement that kind of helps both sides. It helps the fans, it helps the artists, it helps the game. So I think it's a cool thing that I feel like a lot more of those games could do. I think it helps build up. I mean, like certain artists who are super well known, who are like professional artists, their name alone is going to sell it. But for these semi-professional people that they seem to have gotten, for some of them, that could be their break easily into going from like semi-professional to full-time. That's very smart. I would not be surprised if more companies start doing that in the future.
So our final review or discussion, whatever you want to call it, is for Hina Matsuri, Volume 1. We got this as a review copy from One Piece Books, who is putting it out in English. And this has a recent anime adaptation, so it's good timing on their part. And it's a comedy about a Yakuza who one day is sitting in his apartment and a weird alien sort of ball thing falls out of nowhere, and inside of it is a girl named Hina who has telekinesis or whatever kind of powers, and she's very, very powerful, but she doesn't really want to do anything except eat and go to school.
Yeah, if you watch the anime, I think someone puts it best when they find out, like, Hina can be useful. They're like, I just thought you were an eating and pooping machine.
And, yeah, every once in a while she gets caught up in some sort of Yakuza gang fight or some operation that happens and, helps out with her super strength. And, of course, then her roommate, I don't know what to call him, the Yakuza that she lives with ends up getting credit most of the time for the things that she has done.
That's pretty good explanation of at least the first book of Hina Matsuri. It gets a little broader, but that is definitely the initial premise.
And so, Al, you've watched the anime.
Yeah.
And this is my first experience with it, so you'll get kind of, both perspectives. I thought that the humor in this series is really deadpan. Like, really, extremely deadpan. I mean, I don't know. I was, like, so surprised that it's very subtle. Like, and deadpan.
Every once in a while, they'll have a nya-nya-nya-nya-nya gag. But a lot of times, it's almost like a British level of, here is the joke. I feel like it has a certain appeal, but other times it can come off as a little bit dry, like, once again, in a very British way.
Do you feel the humor is the same in the anime, or did you feel like they stepped it up in some way? Or
I feel like sometimes the visuals do spark it a little bit, but especially later on, Hitomi, the friend girl who gets dragged along, she is that kind of deadpan humor, like, times two. So no matter what they do, her humor is always super deadpan. Like that joke where she's being dragged around by Hina, and they end up going to like a cabaret club. And her mom is like, where are you? Why are you staying out so late? And she's like, Mom, I'm at a cabaret club. And she's like, that's a garbage excuse. Now come home.
Like, don't joke about things.
Yeah. That kind of humor only gets wrapped up when she just gets involved in these situations. And she keeps expecting, like, adults to, like, help her out or bail her out. And they just sink her deeper into her, like, sad life.
The humor with her actually somehow struck me more a lot of times. Because Hina and Nita will just have conversations. And if you're just, I don't know, sometimes they're just, I'm like, is this? I mean, it's kind of odd what they're talking about. But it's not, like, hysterically funny, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But then when the friend shows up, there's that part where she... They, like, rope her into bartending, and they're like, dude, she's, like, a bartending genius. She's a prodigy. She needs to become a bartender. I don't know, like, if somehow her being there, maybe it's because she actually understands that what is happening is ridiculous, and nobody else seems to ever react to anything as if it is ridiculous.
Well, I feel like a lot of times... comedy has, you know, usually has like a funny man, straight man. And her job is always, if there is no other straight man, she becomes the full straight man because that is her role in existence, to be like the one who's like, oh my God, what is going on?
I think I did appreciate in this series that at least here at the beginning, and I don't know if this changes, but I would hope that it wouldn't, is that they do not bother to try to explain anything. It's just, here's our absurd premise. That's what it is. Go. Like, go forth. Here it is. And I feel like it takes a certain type of series maybe to make that work, but I just... You know, sometimes if people start trying to make things fit, even in, like, its own world, it just loses a lot of momentum. And it's like, it doesn't matter what the reason is.
I will say, the reason is something that they're exploring, but they're pretty good about it organically coming out. Like, there's no let's find out what the deal with Hina is arcs. They just kind of let the story play out and explore these characters, and every once in a while, just because that's happening, you'll find out a little bit about them. Or maybe, because even at the end of the anime, you don't know why Hina is in this world.
I guess I'm saying I don't care. Like, I don't think it matters. If it's just a comedy premise, yeah. Like, if it is just there to be... It's like, I don't know, Mork and Mindy, or like Alf, or whatever. And, you know, anytime you try to explain things in those shows, it's just bad. So, like, I feel like just be a comedy duo, that is, like, the level I appreciated it at, I guess. I was trying to figure out if it's, like, it's almost like a weird alien Yotsuba or something. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, like, a weird, like...
Yeah, no, I mean, Hina's definitely a super odd person that, like, has to be explained weird things. She very clearly does not, like, have, like, a normal mindset. And then Nita is this weird kind of guy on his own, and all the characters are really weird except for the school girlfriend.
Yeah, it's very absurd, but also I don't know, it's just like, it's, I found it kind of just a weird series, is there's also, like, it's kind of dark, but you're not, but I feel like I wasn't sure, I'm like, is it actually trying to be dark, or no, that was just a weird comment, and it was just people being weird. I don't know, because obviously it's about you, there's a huge portion of it about Yakuza, which is not taken that seriously, but they are, like, extorting people for money and killing rival gangs in this manga that Hina is helping out with. And then there's that part kind of near the beginning where she's like, I don't know, she's saying something about, like, oh, the adults here are so weird, they don't just tell me to go kill things or something. Something along those lines, and I was like, okay, that was amusing, but also, is this dark? I don't know. Can't tell.
Well, like, there's one later story where, like, where Nita is like, he's in a barrel filled with concrete and he's about to be thrown into the river and killed because of like this Yakuza internal fighting. And like, they barely like, oh, hey guys, this silly misunderstanding that nearly got Nita killed and all these people killed, it's diffused. Ha 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 ha. And they're all laughing about it. And like, and everybody like, Hina's like, ha ha ha, and all the Yakuza guys are like, ha ha ha, and Nita's like, ha, wait a minute, I'm still in this canister up to my neck in concrete. I almost just died because of this stupidity.
Ha 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 ha.
Yeah, but his ha 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 just becomes like, ha 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 ha.
So it's a dark comedy.
Yeah.
A dark deadpan comedy. There, now we've established its genre. That's what I was trying to figure out.
So, a few things have been watched a little more of the anime. One, they definitely pretty up the art. It's not bad in the book, but they definitely, like, put a much more professional spin on it. It's not like the difference between the Miss Kobayashi Dragon Maid's manga and the anime, which, like, at times you're like, oh, those are the same characters. I see. It does feel a little more, like, rough seinen, as opposed to it looks a little more glossy anime in the anime. They do play around with the story. Like, in the anime, in the second episode already, you've met Anzu, because she's a super popular character, where she only just barely appears in, like, the last two pages of the manga. You've touched upon it a little bit, but there is a little bit of social commentary later on. Like, Hitomi, definitely, like, her whole storyline as it gets crazier, actually weirdly has a lot of commentary on the dynamics between the older culture and the younger culture in Japan and just working life in Japan. And Anzu, I won't go into too much, but she has a really interesting journey and she has a lot of different social commentaries. And kind of like we've said before, like, interestingly enough, Nita's touches on a lot of, like, the Yakuza in, like, this kind of dark comedy way. And there's a little more touching stuff as well. But I feel like that at least appears a little... That's a little more obvious from the first book. I think it would be a little harder to tell that there's going to be, like, some social commentary, oddly enough, in the later stories. Which I just... I feel is, like, very unexpected. But I feel like it's what actually convinced a lot of people to start talking about and, like, watching the series.
Mm.
This episode's food for thought.
Our food for thought, kind of coming off of Hina Matsuri, is what are some of your and our favorite absurdist comedies? Anime and manga only. Don't be thrown in any, like, live action stuff.
Listen to our song!
In the worlds before Monkey, primal chaos reigned. Heaven sought order, but the phoenix can fly only when its feathers are grown. The four worlds formed again and yet again, as endless eons wheeled and passed. Time and the pure essences of heaven, the moisture of the earth, the powers of the sun and the moon, all worked upon a certain rock old as creation. And it became magically fertile. That first egg was named Thought. Tathagata Buddha, the Father Buddha, said, "With our thoughts, we make the world." Elemental forces caused the egg to hatch. From it then came a stone monkey. The nature of monkey was irrepressible.
Born from an egg on a mountain top. The monkeyest monkey that ever popped. He knew every magic trick under the sun. He teased the gods and everyone and had some fun. Monkey magic, monkey magic, monkey magic, monkey magic.
what's your answer to the food for thought? All right, our food for thought, which is, what are your favorite absurdist comedies? You're just crazy, wacky, out there, silly comedies.
All right, I'll start. So, because I think I guessed one of Al's. So, I want to see if I'm right about that, but also, I think this one is also going to resonate with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, my first choice, anime only, not that the manga isn't good, but anime is the heart of this. Kodacha. Such a great, hilarious, and I feel like I haven't gotten to talk about it in such a long time, or really, like, think about it in a long time. For those of you not familiar with Kodacha, it's about a girl who is on, she's famous, she's a child star on this television program, and it's, you know, like a crazy variety kind of a show, and the anime is, like, an insanely long series about her and this guy at school who becomes her rival slash romantic subject, and their insane lives and all the people in their lives. She has a crazy mom, she has a crazy bodyguard slash chauffeur, and it's just, I mean, I think the opening alone, if you have never seen it, one is like classic, and two will give you a great idea of what kind of comedy it is.
It is, I remember, one of those series that gets a lot more dramatic as it goes on. Like, as the series goes on, it doesn't ever lose the comedy, but it definitely trades off with the drama a lot more. Like, they kick up the drama as the series goes on. And, yeah, no, I remember it was, like one of the launch titles of Tokyo Pop, the manga was. Because the anime was, like, almost inconceivable to get. It was, like, one of the, like, holy grails. And then eventually it was licensed, and I remember they never finished it.
Yeah, it's, like, an over 100 episode series, shoujo comedy series. So it just, yeah, like, it, and it's very different from, actually, it's right on Al's bookshelf behind him. But the manga's, you know, pretty short, comparatively, and is gets very dramatic almost immediately.
Also, randomly, it just reminded me that this was a thing that only happened for a while in anime and manga, but it was an anime at the time when they didn't have enough material. They would make a New York arc, because that also happened with Marmalade Boy and I think one or two other series, where it was just like, all right, we're going to pause the main story and for some reason take all the characters to New York for this really long filler arc until there's more manga. Which I feel like doesn't really happen before that and then just stops it.
Let's just start that again. So, Attack on Titan, they go to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, they should have done that in, like, Naruto instead of the training arc. They could have just gone to New York.
Mm-hmm. Or they should have done the training arc in New York.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you could get a lot of practice as a ninja in New York.
It was the weird thing that just happened for, like, that decade. So, Kate, are you going to guess my...
Okay, my guess is if it wasn't that, then it is Galaxy Angel.
Yeah, no, definitely Galaxy Angel is one of my favorite picks from there. I think that it's so interesting that, like, my research about Galaxy Angel, of, like, asking people who are involved, is that they made that anime before the game was done, and so they basically were given the general premise and then, like, yeah, but you don't have to adapt the story. Just do whatever you want. And the director and the staff was like, sure enough. And they just took the characters and just went in this totally absurdist direction where they took the general premise of the characters and they just took, like, because it's mostly like a romantic dating sim game with space battles. And they, it's very much like Sakura Wars in that way. And they were a little comedic, like maybe the comedy in the original games is like 3 out of 10. And they just were like, 10 out of 10 for the anime. Everybody's flaws, make them as comedic as possible. Everybody's merits, just make them silly. And it's great because there is no continuity. Like, there are episodes where, like, everybody dies or the universe is wiped out or they all lose their jobs. And the next episode, everything is just reset. And it's no like Space Dandy where there's some greater meta story. It's just, yeah, it didn't matter. Like, yeah, they all try to get into the combining robot. And they never learn how to combine. And the giant weapon destroys the planet and them with them. In the next episode, yeah, that didn't matter. Here's their next adventure. And once again, it still has the greatest episode where Ronfa decides that they should all go into and join the Battle of the Bands, even though none of them can play an instrument. And it just becomes, the whole rest of the episode is their dumb music career.
I'm sure there's some commentary on there about the way the music industry works or something.
It's more like a parody of, you know, our band gets to the top stories, kind of like a Beck or something. And yeah, it's just like a parody of all those. But the running joke is none of them can ever play instruments. And only one of them ever learns to play an instrument. And in the end, that's actually what kills their careers.
So I feel like the other one I wanted to mention is Cromartie High School. So, like, I think that was a favorite for a lot of people, like, in an era, like, a decade past. And it's still great. And it still deserves to be remembered for Mechazawa and Freddie Mercury on a horse. So, you know, it's a series featuring one of my favorite things, which is, like, a delinquent high school. But everybody there, you know, is not like a cool or horrible evil delinquent. They're mostly, well, some of them are, but most of the class is just kind of incompetent. Except for our main guy who's like, I'm not supposed to be here.
Yeah, no, it also, I always remember, and I love to use this actually as a good example in real life, which is the Kamiyama effect, which, like, one time, Kamiyama's, like, the super straight-laced straight man in the series. And, like, something happens and he gets upset. And everybody, like, starts freaking out. And he's like, what's going on? And he's like, oh, it's the Kamiyama effect. And they're like, what? And she's like, why is this effect named after me? And he's like, ah, no, we're naming it after you for this example. But he's like, you know, when people have a normal pattern of behavior and then they break it, it's much more jarring than when someone who's known for doing that does the same thing. He's like, if someone's usually stupid and they say something stupid, you're not surprised by it. It's just the normal thing that they do. But if someone is usually super smart and always has the right answer and then they do something stupid, it seems out of character. You're in a school of people who get upset all the time. So when they get upset, doesn't move the meter. But when you, who never get upset, even get a little bit upset, we all notice it. And that's the Kamiyama effect.
And it freaks us out.
Yeah. And I always remember that one. I think it's like a really, I don't know if there's actually a term for it, but I actually always use that now as like my, no, it's the Kamiyama effect. I will quickly just throw out one name and then move on to my last one. But I just have to throw out Hayate. But I've talked enough about Hayate on this podcast that throwing in another mention of it more than just this would be, you know, almost redundant.
I applaud you, Al, for restraint.
But because I can talk about...
It's cool. Moving on. Next one, what were you going to say?
So I just wanted to round it out with Lum, Yuritsa Yatsura. Feel like it's the most absurdist of Rumikio Takahashi's comedies. And I just feel like it's old enough that I just wanted to bring it up as like, I feel like there's a certain era of fan who always considers her best work. And I feel like it's probably the one that people look back on in retrospect most fondly. Like, I feel like Ranma and Inuyasha have a little more of a pattern that they fall into. That sometimes people are like, I liked it, but really was repetitive in retrospect. Whereas I feel like Lum definitely had its patterns, but it went in enough weird places and played with the formula enough that I feel like people... It's the one that gets the most love, even years later.
And it had a lot of good original anime stuff. So, mm-hmm. obviously, like, a lot of the movies and...
Yeah, they were also a lot more experimental with the movies. And they definitely let their creative freedoms go a little more broad.
All right, so just a couple honorable mentions here at the very end. So, Pop Team Epic, I think... obviously very current, so gets an honorable mention. Doesn't get to go on, like, the greatest of all time list yet, because, you know, got to have some time to think about that. And then I think this is a special Reverse Thieves Award that goes to I, My, Me.
Mm-hmm. It feels like it's one of those series where, like, in an actual good, if you liked, then you should try. Like, if you liked Pop Team Epic, you should try I, My, Me.
It's so weird. It's just the weirdest. I mean, if anybody has ever listened to us try to talk about it at any time on, like, a SWAT review or a case closed review, it's very difficult to talk about because it really makes no sense at all. But it's super absurd and is only 3 minutes long episodes, so, you know, an easy marathon for anyone.
And yeah, much like Pop Team Epic and Galaxy Angel, it's one of those series where, like, there is no, like, running story. Do not worry what happened in the last episode. It has nothing to do with this episode. Except for, like, kind of like Pop Team Epic, every once in a while, they're like, let's, like, refer to a previous episode that we've done just to fuck with you.
People die a lot in I, My, Me.
The most fascinating news and conversations from this month. All right. It's we've just been talking about nothing but nonstop comedy and love and laughter. Let's talk about depressing things for the news, because that's what the news is all about, right?
You gotta have that balance.
Mm-hmm. And apparently, there have been just a rise in the number of canceled manga magazines, like 12 this year already, which is definitely... get certain people hot under the collar. I don't think any of them were the, you know, is that like Shonen Sunday or Jump closed, but it gets a lot of people whipping out their think piece articles and, you know, wondering what this means for the rest of the industry.
I also thought it was interesting that it said it was the highest number since 1995. And I'm like, what was happening in 1995 where there was such a significant amount of manga magazine cancellations?
The only thing I could think, and, you know, maybe somebody like Ed Chavez or somebody who's more of like a history of manga person could tell you, but my guess would be that would be like the rise of video game consoles and like computer games. That might be like the what impacted the sales of manga. There could have been other reasons that I'm just not thinking about because I'm not that tied into Japanese history. Like maybe there was like some kind of paper shortage or just that was just a bad year for manga, or maybe there was something else socially or economically going on.
Yeah, I just thought that was, like, an interesting subsection to this article. The other thing I also really found interesting in this article was that it said that children don't know how to read manga magazines. That they're using apps to read manga, and you read through those apps, apparently, like, in a vertical scroll. I was like, tell me more about this. But yeah, it basically says in here that children are losing the ability to read manga magazines.
It's just, you know, it feels like a, like one of those millennials don't know how to read manga magazines.
I was like, but they know how to read. Like, it's not that hard. I don't know. Anyway, tell me more about that. Anyone who wants to.
You know what I noticed was some of the titles, which I find possibly the biggest impact of this. But I don't want to be totally depressing because there might be an alternative. But I noticed there was a lot of things like Betsatsu Hanateyume and Young Animal Arashi, which are, you might like think that those titles are familiar, and I did at first until I realized, oh, they're like spin-offs of Hanateyume and Young Animal. So, at first it doesn't seem that bad. But, from just what I know of talking to people who pay attention to the Japanese manga trends, those are usually magazines where you get like where the magazines take a risk, what's seen as B team or B artist stuff, like you're not ready for the prime time of the main magazine. Maybe your title's too esoteric. Maybe they're worried that it wouldn't get a mainstream audience. Maybe they want you to kind of be semi-professional. They want you to be professional, but they don't want you to be in the big time magazine. So you can kind of like get better at your craft by being in the lesser magazine. And they kind of had like a farm team vibe, to, you know, use a baseball analogy. And it is a little worrying that that seems to be the titles that are disappearing, because, I mean, it's hard enough to be a professional mangaka. I mean, they get X number of submissions and much less gets accepted. So, like, this kind of, you haven't made the full big times, or, you know, you want to develop something that's a little more avant-garde, but you don't want to go, like, full indie manga. Those magazines were always a good place for that. And with physical media kind of being in the precarious place that it is, it makes sense that those are the first ones to go. But I do worry a little bit about the fact that that's where kind of the outsider stuff that's not fully outsider could go. Or once again, where people can kind of develop their craft until they can essentially make it to the big leagues. I know some people are going to counter with, that's why the web magazines are so important, because they seem to be more and more filling that need. But I just wanted to mention that fact that, like, I feel like they had both of them at this point. They had, like, the sister and brother magazines, and now they had the web stuff. I have a feeling that in a few years, unless you're a super popular magazine, that we're only going to have the web ones and the main ones. And I guess that might be enough, but I just wanted to comment on that.
In better news, there is a new app that's coming to the Switch in November, and it's called Inky Pen. And it's going to be an all-you-can-read subscription service for graphic novels, manga, and even Franco-Belgian comics. So it's also launching internationally. It doesn't cover all the world yet. Hopefully it'll expand to places like South America and India and China. But it's got a pretty big reach. And it sounds like, I don't know, it sounds pretty cool. Like, it doesn't, we don't really have a sense yet of what exactly is going to be on here. But we do know that, according to the people that are running, you know, making this, that it is going, not going to sort of like nickel and dime you the way that, say, something like Comixology does, where they have a sort of an unlimited service, but it doesn't include like all of an entire series. So the hope is that like this subscription would.
You know, it's interesting because the all you can watch model has worked so well for basically things that you can see, like anime, TV shows, and even with the fracturing of, there's no one platform, like American TV, it's all over the place. Even with anime, you have Crunchyroll and HIDIVE, and Funimation is still kind of half of its own thing, and, you know, Netflix has a bunch of anime and stuff like that. I feel like you could get pretty much everything streaming somewhere, other than a few notable exceptions. And most of the services have like a pretty good selection. So you could theoretically just have one. You'd miss out on a lot, but you'd have a fairly diverse watching catalog. I mean, there are enough people who like still have a pile of shame of shows they haven't watched, even though they only have one service. But every time they seem to do it for comics or manga or some combination of the both, it does seem like there always is some major restrictions. The only one I could think of that is still going is Crunchyroll Manga, and that always seems like a half project to them. Like, I'm always wondering, like, when is it gonna die? compared to the, like, the anime service I never have any doubt for. Like, I'm always like, so, are they going to kill Crunchyroll manga this year, or is it going to survive another year? And I feel like its selection is pretty diverse, but compared to any of, like, the anime streaming services, it doesn't seem huge. And like you said, Comixology has something that kind of is like that, but it's always like, you get these certain titles, but if you want these titles and these issues, you gotta still pay for them. And even like the DC and Marvel ones are very restrictive about what you can and can't read. And I don't think if there is any service that isn't like that, I can't think of it off the top of my head, unless it's like very indie or very small, and it's like, all right, you get these small selection of titles.
You know, now that you brought it up, I do find that really interesting that somehow it almost seems like people aren't worried about you binge watching, but somehow they're worried about you binge reading. And really, even if you're a subscriber, even if there's an unlimited selection, or not unlimited, but that you have a huge selection, like, you really can't read all of it. Like, oh, I'll just buy this for 1 month and I'll just read every single title on here. Like, that's impossible. Nobody's gonna do that. So I wonder why, yeah, they're so worried about it.
I wonder, and this could just, I mean, I don't know enough about the numbers behind the scene, but I'm wondering how much they just still completely rely on the physical media sales. Like, they still rely on the book sales, that they're worried about cannibalizing it.
I mean, I feel as though I can kind of understand that with things that are being, like, licensed into English, like manga. But for American comics, I feel as though they have a better sense of what the whole product is, I guess, is what I'm saying. So I don't think it really.
The only other thing I could think, and this is, once again, just speculation, is what if it's actually the other way around, that piracy hasn't hit their sales enough for them to really double down on streaming? Because I feel like one of the reasons that all the TV shows and anime started really caring about streaming was that they felt they were losing so much to piracy that, like, they basically had to embrace being in charge of streaming and, like, being in charge of that online aspect, or else they'd just be left behind sales wise. Whereas I wonder if the manga, physical, like, comic market is still strong enough that they're not worried about that. Or at least I'm sure that they're looking at it and fretting about it, but it might not be significant enough that they're willing to double down on the streaming aspect.
My other question, or kind of thing that I'm curious about with this, is how it will work on your Switch, because the Switch is a very long screen, so are you going to be able to turn it so that you can read a manga or any, like, comics page in a vertical format? Because I don't think it currently, like, allows you to really do that. So I'm kind of interested, because, like, I don't know if I would really be interested in this service if I was at home. You know, I'd want it more as, like, a portable medium. So I feel like it wouldn't be a really great reading experience if you had to read it horizontally.
It'll be interesting to see how they implement it. Because I just, when I was coming home 2 days ago, I did see these guys just reading manga on their phone. And I don't know if it was legitimate or not. I wasn't paying too close attention. But I do feel like, and people have mentioned that people are reading much more on their phones and the such. So it seems like a smart idea. But like you said, the Switch is kind of an interesting implementation of it. I do remember, like, when a lot of those readers came out, they had those things where, like, it would only show you a portion of each page and you'd have to, like, click through to get, like, the panels. I wonder if they're going to implement something like that. Although, yeah, the look on your face, yeah. I never felt like that super made anybody happy.
Yeah, I mean, I feel guided view, which is what that's usually, I think that's what it's usually referred to, but is not bad if it's done really well. And I just feel like
it takes so much effort to do it really well that oftentimes it is only okay. And so, yeah, I would definitely be pretty disappointed in something like that. So stay tuned. Hopefully we'll see, you know, maybe they'll have like a free trial of the app or something in November to try it out.
So speaking of projects that people are working on, we have gotten another Kickstarter. But, you know, I'll talk this a little about it more. But this is a Kickstarter that is not to, like, license or make a new title. It's to update a title that they released before, and that is a Victorian romance, Emma. And if the Kickstarter is successful, they're going to put a dub on it and release it. And then, essentially, if bare minimum, you get a nice new release with a dub. And then if they meet certain stretch goals, they'll add a whole bunch of tchotchkes to like the limited edition and extra features. Like I know one of the Kickstarter goals is if they make enough money, they'll do a commentary track with the original author of the manga about at least key episodes, if not all the episodes.
Yeah, so this is also, I think, interesting because it's part of this is to release it on Blu-ray. So that's... Even if you're not interested in the dub, there's that Blu-ray component. And it said that there's not a Blu-ray of this in Japan. So it would be the first time it would be available on Blu-ray. And they're trying to raise over $100,000 to do this. And they are, as of our recording, they're like $74,000 in. And they have 25 days to go. So I think it's going to be an overwhelming success. Isn't there something about, like, if you make this much of your Kickstarter in such and such amount of time, like, you will get it or whatever? I don't remember what the... There is some formula out there.
No. But it's a good sign that if you have that kind of momentum, you should be, like, at least halfway to your goal at this point. Because, like, you rarely get... If you don't have that initial thing, it's very rare that you'll get, like, a big surge at the end that takes you over the top. At this point, it's, like, how much... Like, which of your stretch goals do you get? From what you said, it does seem like it will meet at least the minimum goal, if nothing else.
And I think it's interesting that they have said specifically in the Kickstarter, and I think this might be happening more often. I think a lot of us who, when Kickstarter was, like super big, we were all like backing so many things and like doing, and then you get a sort of like, all right, I'm done for a while. So I haven't done a lot of Kickstarter recently, so this might be something that's like, oh yeah, they all do this now. But it mentions specifically here that they are holding back the commercial release of this through Right Stuff for half of a year. If you back this, you know that it's not going to be out available the minute that you get it. It's also available on the store for a discount for somebody. So I think that's interesting that they've said specifically in this, like, we're holding it back so that makes your being a part of this more important and special.
And it doesn't make it just feel like a fancy pre-order system.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, one could argue it becomes a very exclusive pre-order system instead, but I think at least... Yeah, like you said, it makes it feel like you get something a little more special than just, oh, all right, I got these little tchotchkes because I supported it. But Frank, who just found out that it came out today, can get it just as easily.
Trying to see if there's anybody doing like the crazy backer tiers where you get autographed stuff and... Do you get cells? Let me see here. There's a doll. There's one that comes with a doll. Reproduction cells. All kinds of crazy stuff. I'm seeing if anybody has gone for something really nutso. Yes. So they have a $750 backer. But some of these are crazy. Thousands of dollar backers. They have a person who's at 1,000. Two people. No, a couple of people. It goes all the way up to, looks like, 5,000.
Must be nice to have that much disposable income.
I mean, okay, so nobody has backed the 5,000 tier, just saying. But a few people have done the $1,000. There are some really, like, massive stretch goals on here that are pretty big deal. Like you said, Al, like, commentary track is, that's pretty big.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and if they only make So their goal is 110, and one of their stretch goals is $180,000, and that is only, so that's only $70,000 more than what they would have already raised. They'll dub the whole second season. So, like, that's a good deal. Like, if you can convince people to do that for a backer, that's, like, a really good deal for you, because they're not asking for as much to do it. Seems cool, right? Stuff's cool. I like their stuff. If one of these tiers had a pin, an enamel pin, I probably would have already backed this.
You could finally finish Emma.
I've watched all the first season.
Yeah, that's yeah. What I'm about. It might encourage you to finish the second season.
Right, yeah.
I have read all the manga and finished the anime. That's how.
Maybe they can have you on the commentary track, Al. Yes.
As a made expert. It could be me and Takuchi from Typhoon, and we could be official maid experts.
Excellent. I like that idea.
And I just wanted to mention, really quickly, we actually touched upon this already. If you've listened to the finale of the Record of Lotus Rewatch podcast, but there have been an interesting number of revival novels coming out recently. We got a new Slayers novel. We haven't had a Slayers novel in a while. And more surprisingly, it's back to the Lena Gowry timeline, which I think is very interesting. And then, like, right on its heels, they then announced, oh, we're doing a new Dirty Pail novel, which we haven't done in years. And then after that, they announced that they're doing a new Banner of the Stars novel that they haven't done in years. As we mentioned, they're doing a new short story for Lotos for the anniversary. And it's almost pretty much, I'd say, like 90% of our listening audience will know. There's been a big Legend of the Galactic Heroes revival with the new anime. And that's mostly off the stage shows. But it does seem like they're going back to a lot of these very early light novels and kind of proto-anime novels. And they're getting a bit of a revival. So I think of... And aren't they doing it, and this is kind of like a lower tier, but aren't they doing it like a new Sorceress Stabber Orphan TV series?
There's been a bunch of Orphan announcements lately. I just don't remember what they are.
Yeah, because I remember that Orphan ran in the same magazine that Slayers did, because they had some crossover cards in the Slayers card game, and I think they have one or two other like little crossovers between Slayers and Orphans, because they were two titles in the same magazine that were very similar in tone and setting. So yeah, it does. I just thought it was interesting. I'm kind of curious what other ones. I feel like those are the ones that would be most notable to us. Maybe if like somebody was like, I can't believe you didn't think, like, why aren't they doing more of Sirius X novels? But yeah, it does feel like there's almost like a nostalgia boom to go back to these old titles that weren't, like, officially ended. So, like, hey, let's do another book or two with them.
All right, that's it for another month of the Speakeasy. If you are going to New York Comic Con, we will be there. And we're not, you know, doing any panels or anything like that, but we will do a pre-Comic-Con podcast and talk about all the anime and manga events that'll be happening, as well as what other things we're looking forward to, and the next Speakeasy will have a bunch of our thoughts about the con.
Yay!
That wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit ReverseThieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.